Well, I think it's fair to say that Judges chapters 17 to 21 depict God's people in a huge mess. Now, these last five chapters then of the book, they involve some fairly elaborate plot lines, and it's easy to get very involved in all the twists and turns that take place, and easy to lose sight somewhat of the wood for the trees. But actually, the most important feature, I think, of this final chunk of the book is a refrain that occurs four times. Because that refrain that occurs four times, it explains the reason for this huge mess, as I called it, that God's people is now in. What is the refrain? Well, it's this: in those days there was no king in Israel. In those days there was no king in Israel. It occurs in chapter 17 verse 6, it occurs in chapter 18 verse 1, it occurs in chapter 19 verse 1, and it occurs right at the end in chapter 21 verse 25. In two of those instances, an additional line also appears, that everyone did what was right in his own eyes. So that's also a factor in this huge mess that we have here. But clearly the main reason for this enormous mess is the one that is expressed so relentlessly. More than anything, it's this absence of a king which lies behind the mess. Now, that explanation could seem rather puzzling on two grounds. So first then, we know, don't we, how the Old Testament story unfolds beyond the book of Judges. And of course, God's people do eventually get kings. And yet, far from being the answer to their problems, those kings were generally disastrous, weren't they? There were one or two notable exceptions, but there weren't many exceptions. Most of the kings that did come Israel's way were disastrous kings. And then the other reason that this refrain seems puzzling is that at the end of the book here, the author seems to be forgetting what he has told us at the beginning of the book. Do you remember how back in chapter 2 and verses 16 and 17 we read these words? Chapter 2, verse 16, "Then the Lord raised up judges who saved them," that's Israel, "out of the hand of those who plundered them. Yet they did not listen to their judges, for they whored after other gods and bowed down to them." So there in chapter 2, we're getting a preview of what's going to happen in this book of Judges. We're kind of getting a summary beforehand, if you like. And that line then is very interesting. At the beginning of verse 17, "they did not listen to their judges." And that line seems to be indicating to us that these judges that we have so many of in this book, they fulfilled a teaching role in Israel as well as a delivering role. Yes, they were raised up by God in order to deliver Israel from the particular enemy that was oppressing them at that time, but that wasn't the sum total of their role. They also had this teaching role. Presumably that meant teaching God's law to the Israelites. I know it's quite hard to imagine quite a few of those judges ever doing that. Samson, did he really teach Israel God's law much? Did Jephthah? Well, presumably, quite a few of these judges did anyway. But what we're being told then, chapter 2, verse 17, is that that teaching was disregarded by the Israelites. So the Israelites, yes, they accepted the salvation in most cases. They accepted the deliverance. They liked it in most cases being delivered by the judge, but they didn't listen to the teaching. They were uninterested in the judge's teaching about God's law. They disregarded that. They ignored that. Well, if those judges then couldn't succeed in teaching Israel God's law, why should a king be able to succeed in teaching Israel God's law? Why should a king be the answer? Why should a king be able to get through to these hard-hearted, obstinate, stubborn, stiff-necked Israelites. Why should a king be able to get through to them when these judges had singularly failed to do so? And so, as I say, this explanation then, four times, this is the reason for the mess. Israel has no king. This explanation, it seems unsatisfactory. How can it overcome these two objections that I've just raised? Well, this is how. With regard to the first objection, to judge the institution of monarchy in Israel on the basis of Israel's Old Testament kings is to miss the point. Israel's Old Testament kings are largely inconsequential. The point is that that institution was a channel. It was a pipeline from which one day a special king would emerge, the Messiah. And it's that king, it's the Messiah, that Judges 17 to 21 is screaming out the need for. Not for some Jeroboam or Rehoboam or somebody, but for the special king for whom the pipeline of Israelite monarchy would really exist. It's that king that this mess is showing the need of. And then, with regard to my second objection, this special king would be able to succeed where those teaching judges had failed, because he wouldn't just teach. He would also change the hearts of God's people. I think it's vitally important to appreciate then this messianic significance in this refrain that we have these four times in these last five chapters of Judges. Otherwise, the book of Judges seems to end very bizarrely, doesn't it? I mean, we've said, haven't we, that while, yes, this book is at times very sobering and very salutary and very unvarnished, in the last analysis, it's a book of gospel. It's a book of good news. It's a book about God's amazing grace. The title isn't Judgments. The title is Judges. And it's essentially, more than anything, this book, a catalogue of God-sent saviours, each of whom in his own little way anticipates the God-sent saviour, Jesus. And for a book like that, then, a gospel book, a Christ-centered book, to end simply with an exposure of human depravity, which is how many people read the last five chapters, that seems to be a bit disappointing, to say the least. But I'm saying to you that no, these chapters, they aren't simply exposing human depravity in some abstract sense. They're doing something more specific. In their own way, they are as messianic, these chapters, as the tales of Gideon and Samson and so on. They are showing us why a king who changes hearts is necessary. Why there's a crying need for a king who will be able to reach into the depths of the human heart and change it. More specifically still, these five chapters are showing us what happens when there is some knowledge of the truth, but without hearts having been changed by King Jesus. Because, I mean, throughout these five chapters, throughout the two chapters that we read this evening, you'll perhaps have noticed that there is some knowledge of the truth around, isn't there? I mean, there are references to Yahweh in chapters 17 and 18. There's an understanding of the Levites' priestly role within Israel. There's the whole business of Israel taking possession of the promised land that kind of hovers over what the Danites do in chapter 18. So that there's some knowledge of the truth here in Israel in Judges 17 and 18, but without hearts having been changed by King Jesus. If you like, in posh terms, we have here revelation without regeneration. These five chapters are showing us what happens when those conditions prevail. They're showing us what that produces. Some knowledge of the truth, but without changed hearts. These chapters are showing us what that produces. What it produces, first of all, at the religious level, and that's really chapter 17 and 18, the passage that we read tonight. They're showing us what religion becomes, where you have some knowledge of the truth, but without changed hearts. Then chapters 19 to 21, they are showing us what this produces at the moral level. What happens morally where you have some knowledge of the truth, but without changed hearts. Now you might say, well, okay, this is interesting, that here in Judges 17 and 18 then, we are being shown what happens at the religious level. What happens to religion when you have some knowledge of the truth, but without hearts having been changed by King Jesus. That's interesting, but what's the point in us considering that? Well, let me just say three things quickly in that connection. First of all, it enables us, I think, to better recognize the same thing in our own day. It enables us to better recognize the same thing where it rears its head in our own day. Because this isn't something confined to the days of Judges 17 and 18. Are there not many so-called churches in our land today that are exactly there in that place that I've just been describing, some knowledge of the truth? So the Bible is read a bit, and some good hymns are sung with Christian truths in them, and the vocabulary of the Christian religion is used to some degree, but without hearts, having been changed by King Jesus. Is that not the public face of Christianity in Great Britain today? A situation of revelation without regeneration. And so in that sense, I think Judges 17 and 18 are very relevant to us. And the second thing, these chapters, they lead us to rejoice if King Jesus has changed our hearts. To rejoice in this King who doesn't just Samson-like deal with external enemies, but this King who has access to the fetters that bind our very hearts and has changed them. And he's done it. We haven't done it. We haven't contributed a single bit to it. He's done it. What a King. He is. King Jesus, the heart changer. And then thirdly, these chapters enable us perhaps to be on our guard. Because even as those then whose hearts King Jesus has changed, these features of unregenerate religion, if you like, they can still start to creep back in small ways, in insidious ways, and we need to be on our guard against that. So what then are these features of unregenerate religion? Well, this refrain then that I've mentioned already, we said that it has this crucial role to play in the meaning of these chapters. But it also, I think, plays a role structurally, certainly in chapter 17 and 18. It there plays a role structurally as a kind of divider of the passage. It divides the passage into three sections. So we have chapter 17, verses 1 to 5, and then we have the refrain. So I think verses 1 to 5 are a section. And then after the refrain, we have verses 7 to 13 of chapter 17. Before the next refrain, so that's a second section. Then we have the refrain again at the beginning of verse 18, and then we have verses 1 to 31 of chapter 18, which is kind of a third section. And it seems to me then that each of these three sections particularly highlights one feature of unregenerate religion, as I'm calling it. Religion that possesses some knowledge of the truth, some points of contact with biblical truth, but without hearts having been changed by King Jesus. Such religion will usually display some or all of these three tendencies. So first of all, it's subjective. It's subjective. That's one tendency. And this is the first section in verses 1 to 5 of chapter 17. And the dominant character then in these verses is this woman, whose name we're not given, but who is the mother of a man named Micah. And in these verses then, she apparently has this joyful experience. She has had this large, very large amount of money stolen from her. Now, she knows it's been stolen because she utters this curse when she discovers it's been stolen, but she doesn't know who has stolen it. And it turns out then that the culprit, the thief, is her own son, Micah. And presumably then at some point he is convicted about what he's done. He feels guilty about this. And so he owns up and he returns the money to her. And I suppose at that point she could have gone down the route of being greatly dismayed and greatly angered that he was the one who had taken the money from her in the first place. But instead she chooses to look at the positive side of this, the fact that he has now returned it. And she seems to be full of joy, doesn't she? And I guess we can admire her then for that. And those words at the end of verse 2, "Blessed be my son by the Lord." It's an admirable response at that point. "Blessed be my son by the Lord." Because then the Lord has worked this conviction in him and brought him to this point where he has returned the stolen money. But she doesn't stop there, does she? Then, in her joy, she continues halfway through verse 3, "I dedicate the silver to the Lord from my hand for my son to make a carved image and a metal image." Now, this woman, she's not here abandoning Yahweh. She's not like the Philistines last week attributing Samson's capture to another god, Dagon. She's not here attributing the return of this money to Dagon or some other pagan deity. No, she's adoring Yahweh here. And she's adoring Yahweh in a way which no doubt seemed to her highly appropriate. She's giving up a portion of this returned money as a permanent memorial to Yahweh. But the three crucial words I used there were these: "it seemed to her." It seemed to her appropriate. It seemed to her an appropriate way of thanking Yahweh and adoring Yahweh. And of course she had ordinary logic on her side. Ordinarily you look at her, at this gesture she's making, and you think, well, yeah, she's making a memorial to Yahweh. Who wouldn't want that? There's a memorial to Alan Shearer outside St. James's Park. He was honoured when that was erected. So why wouldn't Yahweh be honoured by this going up? Logic was on her side, but of course God's law wasn't on her side. The second commandment, no graven images. Second commandment isn't talking about worship, the problem of worshipping other gods. That's the first commandment. The second commandment is talking about the problem of worshipping Yahweh, but worshipping him in the wrong way through graven images. And that's what she's doing. And so it was subjective, wasn't it? She was genuine. She was well-meaning. She wanted to thank and praise Yahweh for this development in her family life. And so she does what she thought couldn't fail to please him, regardless of what he has actually said will please him. Jephthah was the same, wasn't he? A few chapters ago. Making that vow, and remember we said, in making the vow before he went off to war, he did not have in mind that the first thing he would meet coming out of his house was some goat or sheep. Sheep and goats don't come out of your house to greet you when you've been on the battlefield. He had in mind a human being was going to come out. He didn't have in mind his own precious daughter, I guess, but he had in mind a human being. And he thought that Yahweh would be pleased with him vowing to sacrifice a human being. Because again, logic was on his side. That's what he saw everyone else doing in the ancient Near East. It seemed spectacular. It seemed such a gesture. I'm going to give to you a human being, Yahweh. But it didn't have God's law on its side. Because God's law was so utterly opposed to human sacrifice. And this subjectivity then, surely this cannot fail to please God. Because it seems so right, it seems so appropriate, it seems so good. It tends to be there, doesn't it? Where there is some knowledge of the truth, but without hearts having been changed. I mean, you think of mainstream Christianity in Britain today and the whole antipathy to the doctrine of hell or the doctrine of the exclusiveness of Jesus Christ, the only way of salvation. Think of the whole advocacy of sexually deviant lifestyles within so-called Christian churches. And it's all then kind of picking up, isn't it? The language that's used in doing this, it's all picking up certain biblical concepts and phrases, the love of God and, you know, the gospel being for everyone and we're all in God's image and so on. All that kind of language is used. But it's this subjectivity that we see in Micah's mother, isn't it? How could a God of love fail to be pleased with us endorsing this lifestyle? How could a God of love possibly want me to tell these people that they're in danger of going to hell? And it seems appropriate and it seems logical, but it's going against what God has explicitly said in so many texts of Scripture. Subjective, and we need to be aware of that, even ourselves then, don't we? That whole language, how could this fail to please God? It's dangerous language in itself, before we've actually said what we're talking about. Just that phraseology is dangerous. It's what does Scripture say? That's what matters. And so this is one feature then of this unregenerate religion. It's subjective, but then another feature, secondly, it's superstitious. It's superstitious. And so here then I direct your attention to the second section of the passage, verses 7 to 13 of chapter 17. And this image then has been made. And in fact, Micah has gone beyond just making this image. He also has an ephod and has these little household gods made. And it seems like he basically has some sort of a shrine, even a mini temple then going on, this guy Micah. And he even appoints his own sons to do priestly duty in this temple that he has devised. But then, of course, Micah one day has this very exciting turn of events happen to him. There's this man turns up at his door, and this man is traveling, he's on the move, and it turns out that this man is a Levite. And that immediately rings bells in Micah's mind. He knows that the Levites were a distinctive tribe within Israel, that the Levites were the tribe that God had set apart to serve in the tabernacle, in the house of God, which we discover at the end of this passage, is presently at Shiloh. And Micah then can't believe his luck. Here I am, and I've got this temple, and I've got these makeshift priests, my own sons, presently trying their best, but here now I have a Levite. This is wonderful. What could be better? And so he ordains this Levite. And this is the thing that really gives us an insight into Micah's mind. What he says at the end there in verse 13. Now I know that the Lord will prosper me because I have a Levite as priest. And you see then this kind of ritualism, this superstition in Micah. He's got this ludicrously deviant situation going on. He's got this, his own private temple with an image to Yahweh and also these household gods in it. And it's all so anomalous and so much in conflict with the law of God. And yet he is convinced that now that he's got a Levite who has the right genealogy, and of course he has a very good genealogy, we discover at the end of chapter 18, he can trace his genealogy back to Moses himself. Now he's got this Levite with such pedigree, automatically that will guarantee the blessing of Yahweh. It's this very reduced idea of Yahweh, isn't it? Like Yahweh is this kind of grouchy baby, and you stick a dummy in the baby's mouth and keep the baby quiet. And here is Yahweh. And, you know, as long as you put the right dummy in his mouth, as long as you give him a few Levite priests, then he's happy and he's pleased. Doesn't matter what else is going on. Doesn't matter what laws you're trampling over. As long as the ritual's right, you're dotting the I's, you're crossing the T's, you've got Levites, then he'll be happy. It's this superstitious approach to things. And again, is that not a feature that you find generally with unregenerate religion, where the some knowledge of the truth, but without hearts having been changed by King Jesus? Again, don't we see it in so-called churches, in our own context? It's all the smells and bells and the christenings and such like. And it's this idea then that somehow going through a procedure, somehow just having the right items, the right objects, the right garments, that will elicit some kind of divine blessing. Irrespective of what's been taught from the pulpit, irrespective of what lifestyles have been lived by people in the church. But again, we're not, even as those whose hearts have been changed, we're not perhaps entirely immune to such thinking. And things then that are in fact used properly, wonderful means of grace, they can be handled superstitiously, can't they? This, a Sunday service. And we can think just because we've been here, we've ticked that box and we've done our Sunday duty, that will somehow please this infantile God who is happy with rituals being performed. Taking the Lord's Supper, having a quiet time in a morning, whatever it might be. This idea then that's just going through certain things, ticking certain boxes, that twists God's arm to bless us and to favour us. We must beware. So this religion then, unregenerate religion, it's subjective, it's superstitious, but then thirdly, it's self-serving. It's self-serving, and this is the third section, the longer section, chapter 18, verses 1 to 31. And here then we have these this tribe, the people of Dan, and it seems, doesn't it, at first like a whole new story is beginning, but of course we soon discover that the plot line of chapter 17 will collide with the plot line of chapter 18 at Micah's house. And these Danites then they set out on this quest to find their inheritance. And it seems so pious. And it seems so good because, of course, the Israelites, they have entered the land of Canaan in order to conquer it and in order to occupy it, in order to take possession of that land that had been promised all the way back in Abraham's day. And remember how the book of Judges began with the tribes, the different tribes doing that and going and fighting to take possession of their particular parts of the land. And here's the tribe of Dan, and they're doing that now, and they're looking for their inheritance, and it all seems so pious and in keeping with this whole promised land project. Except that it's not, is it? Because when it says then at the end of verse 1, that until then no inheritance among the tribes of Israel had fallen to them, that doesn't mean that Yahweh had kind of overlooked this poor tribe and hadn't allocated them land with all the others. No, Yahweh had allocated them a land, a section of the promised land. But remember, we discovered something way back in chapter 1, verse 34. This is what we discovered. The Amorites pressed the people of Dan back into the hill country, for they did not allow them to come down to the plain. The Amorites persisted in dwelling in Mount Heres, in Aijalon, and in Shalbaim, but the hand of the house of Joseph rested heavily on them, and they became subject to forced labor, and so on. So we're being told there then that the people of Dan, there was an area of land that was allocated to them, and you can read of that actually back in the book of Joshua. But at this point in chapter 1, they were unable to conquer that. But clearly now, as we come to chapter 18, they're in a stronger position. They can send an army out now the length of the land. They're in a stronger position now. They could now conquer their piece of territory, presumably. But they're not doing that. Instead, they're wandering to find another place which hadn't been allocated to them by Yahweh. This city of Laish that they here conquer in chapter 18, that wasn't part of the inheritance that Yahweh had allocated to them. So why then, if they are now in a position to conquer people, why are they not conquering the area of land that Yahweh had allocated to them? Well, presumably because they didn't like it very much and they preferred the one that they now find in Laish, because it has all these assets that they describe, the spies describe as they go back. And it's just so wonderful. It's has everything going for it. It's not in the hill country like the land Yahweh had allocated to them. It's in a valley. And it has many advantages. And so you see then that actually it's pure greed rather than obedience to Yahweh that is motivating this. And yet it's the whole thing is cloaked in this veneer of piety. Even the way they so much emulate the original entrance into Canaan. You know, the spies going first and then bringing the report back. And it's all being set up to look so good, to look so vintage Israel. And yet in fact, they are flagrantly disobeying God, who had allocated them a different area of land. And they're doing it because they are greedily wanting something of their own choice instead. Well, that's the Danites. And then, of course, you have this Levite, who we've already met in chapter 17. And he has been so embraced by Micah for wrong reasons, but Micah seems to have genuinely embraced him and brought him into his family. But you notice how that's not quite how the Levite portrays things. As these Danite spies turn up, fascinatingly, they recognize this guy. Presumably, they met him before somewhere. We're not told where they met him before, but they seem to have met this guy before, this Levite. And so they're surprised to meet him, and they ask him all these questions. And this is how he answers them in verse 4. "This is how Micah dealt with me. He has hired me, and I have become his priest." Now, that's unrecognizable, isn't it, from the arrangement in chapter 17. He had brought him into his own family and was treating him as one of his sons, and yet the Levite says, "Oh, he's hired me." Probably wanting to sow in the Danites' minds already this thought that, well, you could hire me if you're willing to pay me more than Micah is willing to pay me. And then, of course, the story goes on, and these spies leave Micah's house, and they go and find the place that they want to conquer, and then they go back to the people of Dan, and this army from Dan sets out, and they come again to Micah's house, and they go and they steal the image and the household gods and the ephod from Micah's house, and they first this priest, he's a bit taken aback by this, what's going on here. But in verse 19, they say to him, "Keep quiet, put your hand on your mouth, and come with us, and be to us a father and a priest." And we read then in verse 20, "And the priest's heart was glad." And it's pure greed then. And yet, again, it's kind of clothed in piety, because we have the rationale given at the end of verse 19. "Is it better for you to be priest to the house of one man, or to be priest to a tribe and clan in Israel?" Which again seems so logical. And you know, you could do so much more good by coming and being our priest and staying here and just being Micah's priest. And yet we know from what this guy has said back in chapter 4 about Micah hiring me, we know that really what's driving him is greed. And so I'm saying then that we keep getting this in chapter 18. We get it from the Danites, we get it from the Levites. There's this cloak of piety. And yet beneath, it's all so self-serving. And again, is that not a feature that you find with unregenerate religion? Some knowledge of the truth, but hearts not changed by King Jesus. Perhaps it comes a little bit closer to home, a little bit closer to the evangelical camp, but you think of the televangelists, the healing ministries that seem so pious and seem so well-intentioned. They seize on verses about healing and blessing in the scriptures. And the men who are performing these ministries, they're driving around in expensive cars and living in huge mansions and making money out of the poor people whom they're exploiting. And so often religion has become self-serving, isn't it? A cloak for greed. And again, it's something that more orthodox evangelical churches are not immune to, and we must always be careful of. And so I'm saying then that this passage, it's showing us what happens when religion has some knowledge of the truth, but without hearts having been changed by King Jesus. And I suppose then the way to close is, again, just to point your attention to the wonder of a king who does change hearts. And perhaps your heart has not yet been changed by King Jesus. And you're in that situation of dabbling a bit in religion. You're here tonight, after all. You're interested in the Bible a bit, and you're interested in Christianity. But there's not been this deep down heart change by the King of Glory, Jesus Christ. And I'm saying you're vulnerable to all these distortions and perversions that we've looked at tonight. And my message to you is to cry out to King Jesus, come change my heart. Almighty King, you who have the keys even to the inner depths of my being, you who alone can break these chains that enslave me, these chains of sin, this bondage I'm in, please, King Jesus, come and change me. Come and make me new. Come and make me yours. What a wonderful thing, as I said before, that we have a king who externally defeats our enemies and internally defeats our enemies. Why would you not come and have him as your king? Amen.